Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Recorded in 1995, Dr. James M. Buchanan, 1986 Nobel Prize winner in economics and professor at George Mason University, and Dr. Robert D. Tolleson, Duncan Black Professor of Economics at George Mason University, discuss the question of whether economic methodology really matters. Their conversation also includes a discussion about the empirical validity of economics. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, I appreciate you coming for this more or less academic conversation. I thought we might start off with a general discussion about economic science, and in particular, both of us have participated in a conference recently that was devoted to the legacy of George Stigler. Got into a lot of Stigler's views, and I know on many occasions your work has been compared with that of George Stigler. I think we ought to start off by just getting you, if you would, to give us an overview of how you think of economics, economic science, and your own role, sort of the combination of your own philosophy and methodology of economics. That's a tall order.
That's a big question. I guess a little bit contrary to what people might think, I don't have a favorite methodology. I've actually worked in a lot of different methodologies. I'm probably identified as an empirical tester of economic theories written by other people, primarily. But, you know, I hold no particular brief for any methodology. I think the methodological anarchists have it right. Whatever works for people to gain insight and to gain understanding about the way the economy or the world functions is fine. Ultimately, I think that things that are brought up in that kind of rigorous competition among scientists and other people observing events has to be confronted with some sort of refutable evidence or basis in fact and reality. And I guess that's would be my methodology. I don't care how you get there. I don't really care where the ideas come from. I wouldn't want to regulate that. But once they're out there, there's got to be a way to choose among them. And my preferred way of choosing among them, if possible, is to put them in a refutable form and test them. And that's Stiglerian, I guess. As we saw at our conference, he was a man like all of us who changed over his career, positions and views on a variety of things. But it wasn't so much Stigler that influenced me as a young economist. After I completed my graduate work under you, I went off to Cornell to teach, and it was by beginning to read the works of Armin Alscher that I began to see a vision of economics that combined what I'd learned as a graduate student and what I wanted to do that could take me somewhere. I could use those concepts that I was reading in Alscher and go somewhere with them. And I got back to Stigler because Stigler was sort of the closest thing to Alscher who was working on public choice problems or public choice related problems like regulation. So that's how I got there. I got there through Armin, not through...
Well, that's interesting.
Through Stigler, and Armin's not really an empiricist. He's a strong positivist. If he would emphasize the same methodological points that the later Stigler would, but he really never did any public choice. He was doing property rights, contracting, so on and so forth. But his books and his principles books and his work had a great deal of influence on me right after I left graduate school. Because you remember that he used to come there in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And the graduate students got to sit in the back of the room while he lectured to this General Electric Symposium of college professors. And he was just, it was an amazing experience to hear him stand there without notes. And you know how sharp he was on any issue. And that's how I got to where I got to, actually, I think.
That's interesting because I didn't know the story about the Alchin influence. I can appreciate that because, as you know, I've said that Alchin is the best blackboard economist I've ever known who can sit up and really explain economics to you. But I gather, to go back to the general methodology point, that fundamentally what you're telling me is that you might agree with George Stigler that nobody should worry too much about methodology until he gets to be an old man. But at the bottom line, I guess, you're telling me that you're also a Popperian, that ultimately there has to be some testability here, some falsifiability, to put it strictly in Popperian terms. So you would classify yourself in that framework, I suppose.
I think I would. I don't know if there's something more subtle than that.
Yeah.
That goes on as you choose whether you accept an idea or reject it. I don't know generally what economic scientists go through when they decide to accept an idea or reject it, but that would be the standard. I mean, people have hunches. Not all theories are testable. We can't afford to test all theories. So you have to make decisions about what you believe, oftentimes without a test. But ultimately, if testing were free and it were possible to conceive of tests, I would like to sort things that way.
So in the final analysis, you do come down, I think, pretty strongly, don't you, that economics fits in the category of a genuine science, analogous to the hard sciences, more or less.
I do. I think it's... and in fact, increasingly so. I think that the advances that Plott and Vernon Smith and others have made are making the idea of confronting economics with real behavior, real-time behavior, much cheaper and much more accessible and much easier. So I think we're getting to the point that this competition of ideas can be subjected to some kind of refutation.
So you're giving a lot of plaudits then to experimental economics.
I do.
As a new frontier in which is now being developed very rapidly, actually.
I do, simply for providing a format in which we can verify some things that that are kicked around by theorists.
So you're, by inference, really objecting to the recent analysis by Rosenberg, Alexander Rosenberg, in which he evaluated economic science, and after putting it up against criteria of a hard science, he came out in the final analysis saying that economics was not analogous to hard science, but rather it was either a branch of contractarian political philosophy, which I was sympathetic to, or it was simply a branch of applied mathematics.
Well, I don't think it's applied mathematics. I mean, different strains of this run throughout the literature, but I think it's a set of postulates about behavior that can be put together, and we can deduce what will happen under certain circumstances, and occasionally we can find evidence in the real world that kind of behavior actually follows. I mean, I haven't read the Rosenberg thing carefully, but I think it's pretty clear, as the old analogy goes, that economics is very much like meteorology. Mm-hmm. It's very much like astronomy. It's not yet like laboratory science in the sense that you have total control over the experimental environment, but it is like sciences in which you have to make some surmise of what's going to go on based on preventing conditions.
Well, I, in reevaluating my own position recently, in writing something as a foreword to a posthumous volume of Carl Brunner's writings, I finally came to the view too that there is more to the scientific aspects than Rosenberg gave it credit for having. But I think it is different in major respects from the hard sciences. But as you know, I've been much more skeptical than you and George Stigler say of the usefulness and efficacy of the empirical part, or the testing part. And I'm perhaps overly influenced by my own professor, Frank Knight, who I remember sitting with him at an empirical paper one time, and he said, it's just proving water runs downhill. Mm-hmm. It does seem to me that a lot of empirical economics, now it may be that in terms of the McCloskey type talk about the use of rhetoric, it may be that given the modern sort of set of scientific attitudes that we may need to prove water runs downhill a lot in order to convince people. But it seems to me that's fraught with danger also, because if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And if you go down that empirical road, you also depend on your empirics coming out the way you think the underlying fundamental postulates are going to deliver. So I wonder about your comment on that.
Well, let me take two steps, one step backward and maybe two steps forward, as Lenin would say. The thing that I like about economics and about testing for economic implications in data and behavior is that I think that finding it is a lovely experience. It makes me feel good to be able to find regular economic behavior in environments where people wouldn't have thought it actually existed. I've done a lot of research about basketball and the actual playing of basketball during a game on a court, which is probably the last place and maybe a trivial place to look for the influence of what we would call demand and supply type considerations going on. What the joy I get out of that is finding it. And the creativity that makes me feel good about that is thinking that I could find it there in the first place. To me, that would be analogous to a theorist concocting a new notion about the way the world works. So that's the joy I get out of what I do, my personal utility, as it were. I'm a little bit forgotten what your question was now, but...
Don't you think that the problem of depending too much on I can appreciate this, and it's interesting, this sort of notion of discovery that validates your hunches and so forth and go on, that can be very exciting. That is very plausible. It seems to me a persuasive argument for the thrill that scientists get from their work generally. But my concern about the overemphasis on empirical work in economics, as opposed to getting the basic logical structure, the internal coherent logic of the system working out, is that if you go down the road that everything depends on proving the water runs downhill, the empirical experimental stuff may be such that you get a result that shows water runs uphill, and you know water doesn't run uphill. That's what I'm concerned about.
Right. I see. As we've noted in other conversations, a primary example of that controversy right now is this minimum wage discussion that's going on, where somebody's apparently found a contrary result. Again, one step backwards, two steps forward. The fun in it for me is to find downward sloping demand curve type behavior in unusual settings. Mm-hmm. I enjoy that very much. And the fun in this business for me has never been to take things that were obvious on the face of it from theory. Mm-hmm. And to say, here's another paper showing that the minimum wage law increases teenage unemployment. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever written a sort of a standard empirical study like that. I'm not interested in them. Mm-hmm. I don't generally read them. The fun in that problem for me would have been some of the early papers that said, well, why do people vote for these things? Well, it's because of the constituency characteristics. Mm-hmm. McKinsey and some other people originally wrote those papers. And to me, that was a new wrinkle that put the public choice side into the model and said, well, here's why we have laws that are abundantly bad for the economy. Mm-hmm. That would be the type of research that I would want to do on that problem, given my methodological approach, not just the regular, oh, here's another quantity theory relationship, here's another minimum wage relationship. That's not something that I think we need to do a lot of, and I think I agree with you about that. I think it's...
But on the other hand, given the fact that people are out there ideologically motivated to prove water runs uphill in that kind of a case, it is true that it's necessary for somebody to prove it does run downhill, as Newmark and others are doing in relation to these other studies.
There's sufficient competition for quote-unquote the truth of all this econometrics that seems to me the right answer will prevail, and if it's muddy, it will stay muddy. I don't think this minimum wage thing is anything more than a pretty serious professional breach of some sort by the gentleman who wrote the study. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it'll last.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the studies that first showed in on the basis of some evidence that in fact you can explain why things like the minimum wage, which to so many of us are obviously inefficient, why they persist and in a democratic process. One of my professors, Henry Simons at the University of Chicago, used to point that out. He was not an empiricist, but he clearly talked about the benefit to the labor unions and how hard it was on the South, for example, the minimum wage at that time in the late 40s. Let's switch the subject matter a bit, and I know that you are very familiar with the sort of competitive structure of the American economy. After all, you served as head of the economics division in the Federal Trade Commission, so you had your hands on directly in that. But how, ask first a very general question, how do you assess the competitiveness of the American structure more or less now at the turn of the century?
Well, let me just give two or three sentences worth of background. I think the competitiveness of the American economy at about 1980 was at a very low point. We had regulated and legislated and litigated our way into a pretty big mess. And the system needed radically to be brought under control, needed to be slimmed down. And I speak mostly at that time of the corporate system. Mm-hmm. We were bloated. The incoming laborers were not well trained, so on and so forth. And what happened through the 1980s was the mergers and the takeovers and the layoffs and the computerization of industry and a whole series of things happened in corporate America that are still going on but have been largely consummated now that have made us, I think, competitive. And I think in the wake of all that, in the wake of the downsizing and the growing, the largeness of the corporate sector, we're going to get government to go on a diet, and we're going to get standards reintroduced into education. And I think the outlook for a competitive economy is extremely strong right now. I think the economy is in very good shape, competitive-wise, and will continue to get better because in the wake of all the corporate downsizing and computerization, you're going to get government downsizing, you're going to get better students, you're going to get better schools. Now, I know that sounds like a rosy scenario, but getting the corporate sector ready to compete was half the job. Getting government under control is the other half.
Well, don't I get a sense of a bit of a throwback, though, to the earlier period with this Microsoft decision? I don't know anything about it in detail, but you would know more about it. What is your sense of that?
Well, I think it's kind of government not knowing what to do. When government confronts innovation and bigness, and you have a choice. You can leave the innovation alone, let them reap whatever market profits that they put themselves in the position to reap, or you can mess with them and say that, well, you're a monopolist and you have to divest this and divest that and so on and so forth. And this present government is taking the course of sort of lightly probing around the edges of this thing. It's not nearly as bad as it was in the late 1970s when government was confronted with an issue like Microsoft. They would propose to break up all industries. They proposed to break up oil refining. They proposed to break up breakfast cereals. They proposed all sorts of radical surgical type solutions. Here the government basically litigates a little bit against practices, but lets the companies go on their way. So it's much softer.
Well, that's encouraging that you would say that. Another area that you've worked a lot in and are still working in, several of us are peripherally in it in the public choice area, is this whole notion of rent seeking. That is to say, if there are profits in politics and you have artificial rents set up, just how do you see the research in that area going or moving, and what are the frontiers there? Seems to me still a very active research program.
Well, in one sense, I think it's like the research now has turned into puzzle solving. And there's so many iterations you can do on the basic rent-seeking framework that people now are just adopting a game theoretic technology and thinking of the new iterations, such as let the losers play. And what does that do to total waste, total dissipation, total rent-seeking? There's a lot of that going on in the literature. And to me, that's interesting, but not terribly exciting. It's kind of the working out of the idea. The other thing that's going on is, I think, that people have noticed the concept. The terminology's gotten pretty widespread. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting back and trying to assess whether it really is a big deal or not. And I think the book is still open on that. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are tending to say that rents, there are tremendous incentives to convert rents into transfers. That's an interesting mm-hmm. question, because it really is a function of how you set up the rent assignment competition. Right now we've got it set up mm-hmm. so that lawyers get a lot of it and mm-hmm. whatnot. So I don't see any natural way out of that. There seems to be some indications that we're moving out of that as people begin to control the incentives to litigate and whatnot, but I don't think we've made any big steps out of that.
Yeah, that was what concerning me. Now, the first part of your response there had to do with the research program more or less in the academy and what's going on, and I think that is of intrinsic interest to us. But I think a more general problem is, in a practical sense, how serious is this problem, and do you really think that attitudes have shifted or turned around in any sort of way that we may be, at least the partial derivative may have changed, and the growth of rent-seeking effort, and especially the wasteful part of it, is at least on the down slope?
I don't see that yet. I see us more or less where we were, and the logic of the rent-seeking model would say that these people will fight to protect their positions. So unless something fundamental changes that alters the odds of who's going to win that fight, I'm not prepared to say that we're out of the litigation wilderness yet. But again, I think the profession too is sitting back and saying, is this really an important idea? Is the actual extent of rent seeking very much at all? Mm-hmm. And as you know, some people say it's a lot, some people say it's a little. Mm-hmm. And that debate will ultimately determine whether this concept is more than a theoretical curiosity. So you just, I don't know that you can tell yet on that.
But again, you're coming back to the research program in the academy. I want to push you a little about the actual practical implications of some of this. You can't say it's not important. When we look at the aggregate numbers, in particular, about the resources in the American system that are going to pay lawyers mm-hmm. as compared to the Japanese system, we have 10 times, I think that's the figure, 10 times as many lawyers per capita as the Japanese. Mm-hmm. Now, how are we going to get out? Surely most of that is waste, I think you would agree that most of you've done a lot of work on organization of law firms and lawyers, and a lot of that is waste resources. How are we going to, if you first acknowledge that it is waste in a certain, I agree there are problems of what do you mean by that and how you evaluate it, but a lot of us sort of, without getting into the details of defining it, would agree that a good part of the payment to lawyers is resource wastage compared to what they could be producing, value that they could be producing.
Right.
And how are we then going to move out of that, if you agree? If you take that as a postulate, then how do we get beyond that?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it. We have set up a system in which they, these so-called rent transfers go to certain parties like lawyers. Mm-hmm. And you could call that a rent assignment system, but it's a result of the way we choose to litigate and the way we aid litigation with legislation, what we allow to be litigated. And to solve that kind of problem really gets you back more into your area of economics, which is how do you design a new system that caps that kind of litigation and get it enacted and agreed to by a lot of people. That gets you more into the domain of contractarian political philosophy or constitutional economics or whatever. So I really don't know how we get out. If there's a few little inkling signs now that it's going to change, but as I said, I don't see a big sweeping tidal wave of restricting plaintiffs' attorneys or any other set of attorneys from ruling the day. I just don't see that yet.
Well, I think I fully agree, and quite frankly, I don't see a constitutional way or a constitutional reform that would modify this much. It seems to me that we may well move through some tort reform and limit some aspects of this, but there are signs that people are getting a bit turned off by some of the excesses of the legal profession. The applications for entrance in law schools is now declining, where it was on the upswing for quite a while. So there may be an attitudinal shift toward lawyers, and maybe as the public comes to recognize that a lot of this is indirectly at least wastage, maybe we'll get some changes. But it's very difficult to me. You put the onus on me to say, well, maybe there is a way we might sort of get a constitutional shift. But I don't see any way we could get a handle on that constitutionally. What constitutional reform could possibly work here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you say that the way now that we hand out government favors, apparently, is what you would call a comparative hearings kind of approach. Everybody brings a big stack of paper up with an attorney and says, I'm best qualified to get this subsidy or to get this license, rather than, for example, auctioning them off or randomly assigning. It seems to me those are margins that we know from the theory of rent seeking and from economics generally that we can work on. Some mechanisms are going to produce bigger stacks of paper than others, and that if we can convince people that they would be better off to allow whatever property rights government's going to dole out to be allocated that way, that would be an improvement. But that's a small improvement. That doesn't get at the general society.
And I suppose in general, if in fact we could reduce the rate of increase in the size of government itself, they're bound to have ultimately that effect. But what about in particular, what about some of these more explicit proposed constitutional changes, would that feedback on this? For example, if we had a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, and in fact that amendment ultimately came into force 7 years or whatever, what effect would that have on this general share of our economy that's going into the rent-seeking wastage? Or, for example, what if we had a constitutional amendment to have term limits? Or how would those feedback on this on this rent-seeking wastage that's involved, especially in terms of lawyers?
Well, I think a balanced budget amendment would be very helpful. No question, as you said, that the rate of growth in government is one of the big fuelers of the growth in the legal industry. There is also talk running around of having a regulatory budget in which you could only have so much external regulatory cost imposed on industry per year or something, and it would be capped after that. That's a constitutional idea that I think has a lot of merit. I'm sorry, there's one other thought I had. Just excuse
about the term limits.
I'm not very much in favor of term limits. Term limits, we have term limits in this country, for example, for governors. Virginia has a term limit for its governor. 16 other states have term limits of one form or another. Typically, what term limits do in those states is they make whatever public program that you're talking about, spending, taxes, regulation, they make them more jerky over time, because when a guy has to go out of office, that is, he's a lame duck, he tries to do things to bind his successor into an opposite political position. So it makes everything jerk around more. It makes it more costly in the sense of whatever business we're conducting through the public sector. It makes it more costly to do. I don't see it. I really think it's a gimmick.
You mentioned Virginia and 16 other states that we've neglected one area in which you've done a lot of work, empirical work, that is the using the states as laboratories to test some of these differences, especially structural constitutional differences. We're probably not going to have time to talk about that, but it does seem to me that we are facing a very interesting period. We might call it a period of the new federalism, where we may in fact be shifting more genuine political authority back to the states, and the fact that states are different and can be different offers a very fertile field for potential investigation.
We
can learn something.
No, that's an excellent point, particularly for young scholars.
Yeah. So I think we will end it on that point, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We've had a good discussion here. Thank you.